Welcome to the Bigger Cashflow Podcast, where we interview business owners and real estate investors that share tips and tricks on how to grow your cash flow and reach financial freedom.
What's up, you guys? Welcome to another exciting episode of the Bigger Cashflow Podcast. Today on the show, we have my good friend Ernesto Hernandez here to talk about what it means to be a remote real estate investor and adding value to others. Ernesto currently resides in Oakland, California, but was born in Mexico and considers himself a Bay Area native. He invests in California and Indianapolis, and while he acquired his first property in 2013, he didn't intentionally invest until 2 years ago. Ernesto takes great pride in helping fellow newbie investors achieve success earlier in their investing journey by helping them gain clarity in their strategy, criteria, process, as he actively does the same. I can definitely say that with confidence, Ernesto is one of the humblest guys that I've met, and he really cares about helping other people. So I'm really excited to bring him on the show to talk about real estate investing. With that said, let's welcome Ernesto to the show. How's it going, Ernesto?
Awesome. Good morning, Bo. I'm doing well. I'm super excited to be on your show. As you know, I'm a huge fan of yours. I love the content that you put out. I never thought that I'd be invited to be a guest. So I'm excited to be here and hopefully provide some useful and valuable stuff to your audience.
Definitely. I think a lot of my listeners might resonate with your story, just living in California and investing out of state, and also how you can be successful by helping others get what they want first, right? So before we dive into all of that good stuff, let's first talk about you. Give us a little background about yourself and what you're currently doing to create cash flow.
Yeah, so I do, I've done some BRRRR just like you, not at the scale that you have. The very first property that I bought was in 2013. I was here in California. It's about 2 hours south of the Bay Area in a place called Monterey. We can come back to that afterwards. I started researching out-of-state investing in 2017. Spent about a year with just a lot of consumption of anything you can imagine, podcasts, webinars, books. I was just inhaling it all. Eventually, I reached the point where I said, I have to take some action. And so I was a little nervous about it, doing it. God, what's like 2,000 miles away? Indianapolis is nowhere close to where we are here in California. But that kind of began my journey in 2018. As of now, I've done some BRRRRs, like I said. I did my first flip. That was an unintentional flip earlier this year. And I'm currently working on some more flips that are more intentional than the ones in the past. So that's kind of a nutshell of what I've been up to.
Gotcha. And what do you do in the day job? So you have a W-2, correct?
I do. So I work for Verizon Wireless. I've been there for a little over 12 years. It's been a good place to be. I think, I have no, some people are miserable in their day jobs. I'm definitely not one of those people. But the specific role that I do, I'm an account manager. I support a territory of kind of smaller locations. I just provide all sorts of support and training, reporting, a lot of strategizing with their leadership to kind of get their performance to pick up, that sort of thing. So a lot of wireless background. That's really kind of what I've done most of my adult life, sales for the most part. So yeah.
That's awesome. So a lot of people around me, just like you, who got into real estate investing all have W-2 jobs, and they originally come from the mindset that they're going to work for 35, 40 years, invest in a retirement account, and hopefully, fingers crossed, once they get to 60 or 65, they'll have enough money in the bank to happily retire, right? So tell us about how you decided to invest in real estate and what triggered that journey.
Good question. I've always been a really good saver. And I think that comes from, quite frankly, kind of a scarcity mindset. I am a first generation immigrant myself. I definitely come from humble beginnings. I wouldn't say I was, in extreme poverty, but yeah, I grew up under the, what the government considers the poverty line. I'm used to, my parents working multiple jobs and really kind of low end, you know, service sector, hotel, restaurant job. So that's what I was used to. I was always myself kind of good in school. I focused a lot on my academics. I think I realized at an early age that if anything was going to change the trajectory of my family's future, I had to really focus on my studies. And so I always did well in school. And whenever I did come across money, I was pretty protective of it. So in my early 20s, not really knowing why or understanding the mechanics of it, I think I was 21 when I started my 401k. So that was probably one of the smartest things I've ever done. And that just has kind of grown exponentially over time. As it relates to just any cash, I'm not really one for vices of any kind. I used to be really big into Michael Jordan sneakers. That's one thing that a lot of people don't know about me. I had tons of those things at like $150 and $200 a pop. So that at a younger age, that was kind of my vice. But beyond that, I've always lived well under my means and been a pretty good saver. And then you reach a point where you realize that you can't save yourself to success. You have to start looking at different vehicles and avenues to grow your income and have your money work for you instead of it just sitting in a bank account. And so I started looking at different options. I spent some years, aside from my 401k, I was actively trading in the stock market. I rode, I probably should have stayed on it because it continues to go up the FANG train, tech stocks of Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Netflix, Google. I think I had a little bit of everything. And that hit a pretty successful kind of 3-year stretch. And that was when I decided to shift into real estate. So that is kind of the long journey as to how I got here. Again, just very pragmatic with my money, got into the stock market. And then after that, I realized this is not what I want to do. I want to have more control over my money. And I started looking at real estate.
That's awesome. I already now know of the title, Trading Jordan Sneakers for Rental Properties. I didn't know that about you. That's really awesome.
Yeah, it got to a point where I had to start. This is when I still lived with my mom. I moved out when I was 18. But in high school, I was just on a tear. My mom was like, this is enough. There's no more space. You keep wasting money on these things. So I had them sent to friends' houses and I had to go pick them up afterwards because I didn't want her to see them on the doorstep.
So what happened? Did you end up liquidating those for like a profit or are you still keeping some?
Yeah, I sold most of them. And funny enough, I mean, now everybody knows that the sneaker market is ridiculous. Like what it has grown to now is just kind of insane. So yeah, I put them on eBay and a lot of them, even though they were used, I mean, none of them were abused, but some of them were used. I just gave them a light cleaning and what people were paying me for these things was kind of crazy. So I did liquidate most of them and I'm pretty sure I at least got my money back. So in hindsight, not the worst thing I ever did.
Yeah, no, that's a fun hobby too. I know some other people collect watches or baseball cards and, you know, Jordan sneakers. I feel like there's some of my friends who do the Yeezys and all those like fashionable shoes as well. And it's crazy. Like he waits in line, like, you know, a couple of days, like he needs to submit like a raffle sweepstakes and he gets selected and he waits in line and then he can sell it right away for like 15 times what he paid for.
It's like now they do a raffle system, so there is some luck involved. And back then it was strictly first come, first serve, so some people would in extreme situations camp out. I remember Nike Town San Francisco, people would, it would make the news, you know, like this person's been in line for 3 days waiting on the new sneakers. That's when it was something like super hyper limited. Mm-hmm. But even for generally limited stuff, friends and I would camp out overnight at malls because it was first come, first serve. There was no raffles. There was no wristbands that they would give you. So that was, God, that was like 10, 15 years ago. That seems just, like ages
just
ago.
Get some elbow protection gear and just be like,
yeah.
Get out of my way. It's awesome, man.
Yeah.
So that kind of, you know, triggered your interest in real estate. So when you first decided, hey, I want to invest in real estate, what was that like? Were you trying to get your primary residence first locally, or you knew off the bat that you needed cash flow? And how did that timeline look like from when you first started studying for it until you locked down your property in 2013?
Yeah, so a couple things happened that really enabled me to be in the position that I'm now in. One, going back to that house that I bought in 2013, It was a property that I actually bought to help my mom. So my mom's dream was always, you know, the typical kind of, you know, in an immigrant's mindset is, you know, to have your own house with a white picket fence. And that's exactly the house that we found for her. Her house has a white picket fence. It's funny. But she, you know, she was getting more and more serious about wanting to own a home. You know, we lived in a, you know, initially as a kid, we lived in a one bedroom apartment. It was a one bedroom apartment with a living room, and there was 10 of us that lived in it at one time. So that kind of illustrates the environment that I grew up in, which to me was normal. I didn't know anything different. And then in high school, we moved from San Francisco to Monterey. We had a two bedroom apartment, and there was less of us, but it was still six of us. It's still, you know, still a little crowded. And for my mom, you know, one of her dreams in her life was to own her own home. And I wanted to help her do that. So at that time, we put 20% down. Her and I split the down payment. I didn't really know what I was doing. I really thought through kind of the ramifications of it. I got actually, you know, a lot of pushback from people in my own family. Well, what happens when your mom gets old and she can't make the rent? What are you going to do then? I didn't really care. I didn't know. I just knew that I wanted to be a good son and help my mom achieve her dream. And so we did that. Fast forward, you know, to 2017, I started to realize how much it has appreciated, combined with my own decision to want to get interested in real estate, and just kind of started piecing it all together and knew that I could probably tap into the equity to then start funding some of my own deals. 2017, again, was a heavy study year for me. Which led me to taking, again, that first step and that first investment in 2018. So hopefully that provides enough of a backstory as to how I arrived at that decision. And coming back to one of your earlier comments or one of your earlier points, I'm of the approach that, yeah, I don't want to work at a job for the sake of the benefits and have to be there until 60, 65. Now I'm hearing people that aren't retiring until 70 because there's not enough in their social security. I don't want to be one of those people. So I knew that I'm going to have to do things differently, and real estate through a combination of rentals or flips, or really there's all sorts of ways to achieve that. You don't have to wait nearly as long.
Yeah, no, definitely. I totally agree with you. So in 2018, when you bought your property, and is this starting out in Indianapolis or is this still in California?
Yeah, this was in Indianapolis. So that was my first out-of-state purchase. I had done some market research, again, throughout 2017 to kind of narrow down where I wanted to get started. One of the books that really got me thinking this way was David Green's book on long-distance real estate investing, and he just made it seem so easy. Come to find, it's probably not as easy, but it's also not that hard. It's also not that different. But that was really the book that got me to realize, you know, I can get started over there, just because, you know, in much of the country, the barrier to entry is so much lower. So you can acquire rentals and start, you know, generating cash flow without having to wait until you get to a certain point to meet the price points that you have to hit. Here in California, then you start looking at the returns, you look at the tenant laws and all that good stuff, and you realize out of state is probably a better place for me to be. As you've realized, and you know, a lot of other people that you and I are in frequent communication with also realize.
Yeah, no, definitely. And definitely shout out to David Green and his book. I've read both that and the Burr Method. And I would say his books are actually one of the more technical that help you on the how-tos rather than just like the fluffy mindset ones. But definitely you have to caveat that with David covers a lot of the basis in terms of what you can do in terms of due diligence, your research, your mindset, all that good stuff. But the other side of that is sometimes out of your control, like some of the people that you place your trust in, you got to really vet them correctly, right? Because a lot of the issues that probably might come up is number one, not setting expectations correctly. And number two, just getting in partnership and in bed with the wrong people. Well, we could talk about that later, but just wanted to caveat that there. But that's a great book. If you are interested in out-of-state real estate investing, definitely check that out. If you're looking for insurance coverage for your rental properties, the company that I trust is Ross Diversified Insurance Services, a national insurance agency that has been providing insurance coverage for real estate investors for over 30 years. Whether it's a rental or a fix and flip, Ross provides you coverage through A-rated insurance carriers to provide you with competitive rates, as one size does not fit all. Check out biggercashflow.com/RDIS to get your free quote today. When you're purchasing your first property or the next, you want to work with an experienced lender who's got your best interest in mind. Sean Huss at Chemical Bank has been a professional in the mortgage industry for over 25 years and has helped hundreds of investors like you and me grow their rental portfolio. With expertise in areas such as real estate sales, title and escrow, and the mortgage closing process, Sean is able to provide comprehensive counsel to guide you throughout this often complicated process. Check out biggercashflow.com/chemicalbank to get pre-qualified for free when you mention the Bigger Cash Flow podcast. So, Ernesto, why Indianapolis? I know my listeners have heard me talk about Indianapolis a lot of time. I had Ryan and Ashley on the show talk about Indy. For you, why did Indianapolis make sense?
In hindsight, you know, some of the things that stood out to me, the barrier to entry, the price to rent ratios are favorable if you want to do rentals, which I know that you do a lot of. The economy is pretty diverse. They don't really rely on any one or two sectors. It's a really central location, which is something you don't realize until you're there. Maybe like I didn't know where, and I'm pretty geographically savvy. I didn't know exactly where Indianapolis was. And so some people may think that it's kind of in the middle of nowhere, but it's really not. I mean, it's close to Chicago, Columbus, Ohio, Louisville, Kentucky, St. Louis. It's kind of in between all those. The way the city itself is built out, kind of the highway system, the quick access to the airport. I personally think that city has now, you know, having spent the time there that I have and becoming more familiar with it, I think the city has a huge potential for growth into the future. Part of it has to do with the neighboring states and kind of what's going on in the state of Illinois. Again, just the kind of the fundamentals of what we're going on. The other thing that I looked at is I looked at some historic data going back to see what happened during the last downturn of, you know, 08 to 2010 or so. And it barely budged in terms of valuations for home sales and also rents. So it was kind of bunker proof, if you will. So it just felt like a really kind of steady, predictable, kind of slowly appreciating market that didn't fluctuate a whole lot. And given that I can afford to get started there, that was really one of the things that drew me. I remember the very first meetup I ever went to was January of 2018. And coincidentally, I sit at a table with a couple of guys and we do some introductions, and two guys were already active in Indianapolis and they were local to me. And I kind of started, you know, I asked, hey, can I message you if I have some questions? And they said, absolutely. So that kind of gave me a little confidence boost as well. I knew some people that were already active. I could ask them questions. And that was helpful. And I think more than anything, it just helps you get past some of your limiting beliefs that this is something that you can't do. And you're all of a sudden at a table where these guys are like, yeah, we've been doing it for years. It's really not that hard. So that was a big confidence for boost. And that triggered my first trip out there. And I think it was April of 2018 when I took my first flight. And then a couple months later in June of 2018 is when I purchased my first ever property out of state.
That's awesome. I feel like your journey and mine are so similar. That's when I started, in January of 2018 as well. I think February is when I first flew out to Indianapolis. I was going through my Instagram recently and I saw like a story that I posted where in February I was in Indy and I got out of my Airbnb and my car wouldn't start. It was sort of on cold and it had
so cold.
I had to try it a couple of times and it finally worked. And I was just not used to that, you know, being from sunny California, right? But It's crazy. I also went to the Bay around that time and I went to a meetup. So I went to the Bay for business. I used to go to business trips because I had a lot of clients in biotech. And what I used to do when I go there is, you know, at night, I would just grab dinner with friends who are there locally. But instead of that, because I was so into real estate now, I would look for meetups in the Bay Area. And this one I found in, what's that city across the bridge from Fresno on the east side? Too many, right?
So Fresno is like 2.5 hours away from here. You're probably thinking San Francisco, across the bridge from San Francisco.
Yes, across from San Francisco, but below
Oakland.
Below Oakland.
San Leandro, Hayward, Fremont.
Oh, Fremont.
Thank Fremont. You. Okay. Fremont. Okay. Oh yeah. There's two. Well, there's more bridges. So there's actually three bridges up and down the bay. Just the San Francisco. Then there's two. I forget the name of the other two. But you were probably in Fremont. You probably left Palo Alto. That would
yes.
make some sense. Yep. Or you may have left San Mateo because there's a big biotech scene in South San Francisco. That's where like Genentech and I think Gilead has an office there. So you were probably in Fremont.
So yeah, I was in Fremont and there was a meetup and this was like an hour, like 45 minutes away with traffic and all that. So I'm like, I hope I'm making the right decision. And there I met a lot of people who also invest out of state. And these guys, literally it's the millionaire next door because some of these guys are older. They're not dressed in fancy clothes. They don't drive fancy cars, but they're like, oh, I have a dozen properties in the Bay Area. Or I have like 80 units, or I have some commercial buildings. I rent to CVS. I'm like, what? And this was me just starting out. So I really couldn't fathom. But what I always love is reverse engineering things. So I really try to find somebody who I want to model after, see how they did it, and just kind of repeat it. Because I don't need to reinvent the wheel in most cases, right? I mean, some cases, you want to be more efficient and you want to change up the process and make it your own. But in other areas, you really don't have to recreate the wheel. So as you were telling me that story, you're sitting on that table with some of the other more seasoned investors. It took me back in time just reminiscing about that. And now connecting the dots, looking back, it definitely wasn't as hard as I thought. Like when I was first starting, I'm like, oh shoot, like how am I going to buy my first one? I'm worried about taxes, setting up a bank account. Liability was huge. I was like, what if I get sued? And all of these, a lot of questions are just noise that prevents you from taking that first step in action. So, you know, not to get all preachy, but just getting me excited kind of listening to your journey.
Yeah, I think in general, it's funny, I had a conversation with a friend recently, but you think of like, I think of my own circle and the people that are really successful, like they're actually not the smartest people. I mean, there's sometimes, you know, ignorance can be bliss. You just have no fear of failure. And so they're out there just, you know, overachieving compared to what we think they would. And then you have like the super really smart, over analytical people that are standing at the edge of the cliff and they just are afraid to take the lead. But yeah, it's not until you attend some of these meetups that you realize how approachable and how similar people are to you. A lot of them are first generation immigrants. They drive really simple cars. Perfect example. That was one of the books that really kind of got my mind working too. The Millionaire Door, and I just agreed with so much of it. That's funny you should say that.
Yeah, no, definitely.
Yeah.
So you bought your first property in June 2018. Walk us through that deal, how you found it, how did you go about doing the due diligence process, anything that you would do differently knowing what you know now?
I would do a lot of things differently. I was really excited and B, I wanted to get out of the kind of analysis paralysis. And so I didn't do as much due diligence on it as I should have. It definitely has came to bite me in the butt. But even then, and coming back to your comment about overthinking it, real estate is actually, I think, a very forgiving industry. And, you know, time alone heals a lot of those wounds. Part of why we do this is because we know that, you know, over time, real estate tends to appreciate. So if you're willing to hold through some of the mistakes, you're very likely to come out ahead. That property was from a wholesaler who I met on my first trip there. Got me really excited. I don't blame the wholesaler. It's 100% my fault. And I just took them at their word. A few of the mistakes with that property going forward, I do not like to buy properties that have tenants already in them. It doesn't allow me to rehab it to the grade that I would want to. It's really hard to update a property with a tenant in it. It was in a flood zone, which I didn't realize until I financed it. I did the BRRRR strategy on that one. And the bank says, hey, did you know this is in a flood zone? You're going to have to get flood coverage. I had no idea. The biggest mistake is that I didn't even get a home inspection on it, which I strongly recommend nobody ever do. So given all those mistakes, I could be in a much worse position on that home. There could have been something super detrimental that was wrong with it. And thank God on that one, there really wasn't. So hopefully that answers all your questions about what happened with my first property. But it's still, you know, it still just got me going. And sometimes that's all you need. And you get over your own fears and you realize, to your point, it's really not as complicated as some people like to make it. And I'm still grateful that I went through the experience that I did, because it's taught me so many lessons that I, you know, now build into my actual due diligence checklist. And if I would have ran that home through the checklist that I have now, I would have avoided all those things. So still grateful that it happened.
No, I love that. And I probably mentioned this on the show a lot of times, you know, knowledge without action is useless. So you need to gain that knowledge first, but also take action, right? So which is what Ernesto did. But on the flip side, action without knowledge is dangerous as well. So you got to make sure that you do your research. Now, I do want to ask you, you mentioned you didn't get an inspection. Was it because you didn't know that you needed to get an inspection at all? Or on the flip side, was it because, looking back, you kind of placed a lot of trust with what the wholesaler says? You figured you'd save a couple $100 and things like that.
I think it was a combination of things. You know, when you're new, you're super impressionable. And if you don't have a guide to follow, it can be easy to forget certain things. Coincidentally, you know, when I think about all the books that I've read about real estate investing, you'd be surprised how few people make it a point to, like, okay, if there's a cardinal sin, this is one of them. Don't buy a property without getting it inspected. I can't really think of any books. Maybe I'm reading the wrong ones and that's why, but you know, not many people make a big deal out of the inspection. So that was probably part of it. And I think the second part, again, I really wanted to stop kind of making excuses for myself and overthinking it. And this organization and this wholesaler made it seem like, hey, based off what you told me, this is the perfect one for you to start with. At that point, it's like, who am I to say no? Because there's also a point where, you know, this works with mentorship too. There's a saying that goes, you know, if you don't take action on the things that your mentors tell you to do, your mentors are going to stop mentoring you. And so if you continue to be that person that, like, hey, this is my criteria, hey, I want to get started, and somebody puts a deal on the plate that checks off your boxes in terms of the criteria that you have, and you say no a bunch of times, eventually you're just not going to get sent any deals. So I want to avoid that from happening as well. And so because of all those things combined, I said, you know what, let's just do it. And I did. That's kind of how it played out.
Yeah, I mean, and that's exactly the reason why I wanted to dive in a little bit deeper into that, because I see it many times. I see it from a lot of the people who reach out to me on the Bigger Cashflow podcast and ask me, hey, I want to start investing. And I provide free advice all the time. So if you send me an email, send me a DM on Instagram, more happy to kind of share my knowledge as best as I can. More often than not, I do see people not doing inspections. And, you know, if you look back, a lot of the problems happen because they didn't get an inspection. And I ask them, hey, did you, you know, not know that you had to get an inspection? And they mentioned, well, I thought I'd save a couple $100. I sent my realtor in there. I sent my contractor in there and they said it all looked good. Well, they're not professional home inspectors, right? So they don't have the knowledge and the training to go through those things. And like Ernesto just mentioned, I think that's a key point there. Without something to guide you, you're not really going to know what you're missing. So Ernesto now has this checklist that he's going to go through to make sure he has his T's crossed, I's dotted. I have the same thing. I have a Trello board. Every time I do a due diligence, I do an acquisition, I send it to my contractor, to my property manager, I make sure I get all of those documents, because it helps next time you need to do a tenant turn, or next time you need to do a refinance, you make sure that you have all those documents, right? So just really wanted to drive this home, saying that if you're going to get into real estate investing, number one, it obviously you need to take action. That's good. But number two, you need to make sure that you have some foundation in place of your criteria and your processes. Just make sure that you're going to constantly refine it and sharpen it based on your experience and your knowledge that you gain. Because in the beginning, you don't know what you don't know. But if you don't have anything to guide you, you're going to make a lot of mistakes. And some of those mistakes might be so big that you really can't climb out of, and it's going to put you like 10 steps back, right? So I just needed to say this because I see a lot of people reach out to me and they're losing a lot of money. So you really want to make sure that you have some sort of criteria in place. Anything to add on that, Ernesto?
Yeah, you know, we're kind of in the same community. And so we speak to a lot of the same people. A lot of our network kind of overlaps, and same, you know, even really experienced investors I know that are overlooking really critical things, and they're running into issues, being able to maybe rent out or sell their homes at the price that they were hoping for because something important got overlooked on the inspection. It happened to me recently as well, and this kind of goes home to drive. It goes on to kind of drive this point home that it helped to have multiple people looking at the property. I was looking at one that had some foundation issues, and those issues were called out in the inspection report, but they weren't really like emphasized. And then I had my contractor go over there, and he made a bigger deal out of it. And we dug into it a little bit deeper and realized, okay, this is a bigger issue than we initially thought. So having an inspection is critical. And if you can help it, having multiple people look at it, on the most recent one that I acquired, maybe now I've touched the hot stove that your mom tells you not to touch. I had an inspector look at it. I had my contractor walk it. And then I had a foundation specific inspector come by and look at it. And all three people confirmed that the foundation was rock solid. So now I feel super good. So yeah. It also, like, I get that some people might want to avoid, because, you know, in reality, your actual inspection process is going to be more than just the home inspection. You know, after that comes the sewer inspection, which a lot of people, I mean, that one, if I almost never hear about the home inspection in a book, I've never read about or heard about getting the sewer inspected, which we know in Indianapolis can be a huge issue, especially in older homes. But it's not just trying to skirt around spending the $350 or the $550 to get a home completely inspected. It also gives you leverage. Like, if you have an inspection report, there's an issue, it actually gives you leverage in terms of your offer to get a better deal. So there's so many reasons why you absolutely need to get an inspection. So I'm glad that we spent a good bit of time going over that.
Yeah. And also, if I were to take a look at the homes that I inspected and passed up on, probably spent at least 10. So, you know, at $300-$400 a pop, it's $3,000 to $4,000 I spent on homes that I inspected and I ended up passing on because the numbers just didn't work after that. So it happens. But on the flip side, I could probably make 10 times that loss on a flip that I do successfully, right? So yeah. The cost definitely, the benefit definitely outweighs the cost. And one other thing that I wanted to mention is you definitely have to ask the good questions to get good answers. Like you mentioned, Ernesto, more times than not on inspection reports, like it's going to say like foundation, get a qualified inspector to give you a opinion on the foundation. That home inspector is probably not trained well enough to give you a foundation report. Like maybe an engineer needs to take a look at it. In those questions, don't just brush it off and look into that question a little bit more. Call your inspector and say, hey, what's up with this? You know, how severe is it? Should I get an engineer there right away? Just ask those difficult questions, because especially when you're beginning, I was there when I felt like, oh, is this a silly question? Is this a stupid question? What if my wholesalers be like, hey, forget you, bro. I'm going to move on to the next buyer because you're burning all of my time. Well, too bad then. You're going to skip on that home. Maybe you're going to save $10,000-$15,000, not dealing with that headache, right? So in the beginning, if you're a newbie, please listen to this. I know you might feel pressured to buy a home or, you know, work with certain people and all of that, but you do have to protect yourself as well. And you do that by asking, you know, those questions. There was definitely a lot of good nuggets of information for our listeners in this episode. We're actually going to make this into a two-part episode because Ernesto has a lot more to share with you guys. Next week, we're going to talk about how he came to form the Out-of-State Indianapolis Investors Facebook group, the value of networking and adding value to others, how to get to yes whenever you're negotiating with vendors or sellers as it relates to real estate investing or people in general, the importance of not burning bridges, and how he has secured some private financing for his upcoming flip. So if you want to learn more about those topics, please tune in next week for another exciting episode of the Bigger Cash Flow Podcast. If you thought this was helpful, please do me a favor and leave us a review on iTunes. We'll see you right back here next week for another episode of the Bigger Cash Flow Podcast. Thank you for listening to the Bigger Cash Flow Podcast. Please remember that opinions of the guests are their own, and nothing on this show should be considered personal or professional advice. Please consult your tax, legal, or financial advisor for personal advice that fit your unique situation. See you next time.